Morning. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back to Yechezkel. Nice to see you all after Pesach. Hope you're enjoying your Chag. We are picking up from a very intense time in Jewish history. We just finished Parak Zion, where Hashem essentially had said the time has come, the punishment everybody has sort of been waiting for is about to arrive. Now, the next few prakim, I would say, on the one hand, are very tragic and sad, but they're also really cool. Let me say it that way. The way that Yechezkel expresses his prophetic experience is very unique and really just fascinating. It's almost like a movie if you follow along with him. So we're going to pick up from Parak Chet in Yechezkel today. And I'm going to share my screen in case anyone doesn't have the text in front of them. And we shall begin. Now, as we read this, I think it will be important to keep in mind this is not a standalone chapter. This is a continuation of what we've seen. And this is actually the beginning of the third prophecy in our book. We began at the very beginning, if you remember, with the very elaborate description, although difficult to description to understand, of the divine chariot that Yechezkel sees leaving Yerushalayim. That was in chapter one. We had a second vision beginning in chapter three. That involved, if you remember, Yechezkel doing all sorts of gruesome things. Maybe we'll come back to that. Fasting and then being alone and concealed and confined, shaving his hair. That was the second vision. That has finished. This is a third vision. And it picks up from those two. And if you remember, the book starts in the fifth year. In chapter one, the very beginning of the book starts off in the fifth year of Galus Jehoiachin, the exile of Jehoiachin, who is one of the kings of Judea. That's the beginning of the book. Now we pick up from 1 year later. I'm not going to get into the whole calculation, but parenthetically, if you remember, earlier, just a few chapters ago, Yechezkel was told to confine himself in his house for a very long period of time, sleep on his left side, then his right side, or was it the other way? I don't remember. So it's unclear whether or not he actually did that, because if he did do that, then it doesn't necessarily add up that this is just the sixth year. The prophecy started in the fifth year. It should be beyond that. Maybe it was a leap year. This is a discussion. But either way, we're picking up in the timeline here. But remember that vision. It might be relevant in a minute. So it says, Vahi bashana hashishit. It was the sixth year. Bashishi on the sixth day, Friday. B'chamishal ha-chodesh, on the fifth of the month. Ani yoshe beveiti, I was sitting in my house. V'ziknei Yudai yoshvim lefanai. And the elders of Judah were sitting in front of me. Why would the Ziknei Yehuda be in Yechezkel's house on Erev Shabbos? It's generally, why do you think the elders of Judea would visit Yechezkel?
He would be telling them something.
Right. Well, he's a prophet, you know. So someone worthy of visiting. Abarbanel says something very interesting. He says, as an introduction to this chapter, this chapter is triggered. This prophecy is triggered by the request of the elders of Judah, because these Ziknei Yehuda are in Yechezkel's house. Where is Yechezkel's house? Give me a country.
Bavel?
Yeah. So these Ziknei Yehuda are in Galut. They're in exile. And they want to know, look, we've heard all these prophecies of destruction. We've been exiled. We're here in Bavel. But as far as we know, the temple has yet to be destroyed. And they ask Yechezkel, is it actually going to happen? Mm. You know, so far, Nebuchadnezzar has refrained from going to Jerusalem and toppling the city. So what is actually going to happen? It's a Barbanel suggestion here. It's worth noting also that this prophecy takes place in Yechezkel's house. It's the third prophecy. They all took place in a different place. At the beginning, the first prophecy is at Nahar Kvar, the river of Kvar. And we have an elaborate description of the divine chariot. The second prophecy takes place in the Bik'ah, in a valley. This one takes place in his house. And it's the Pasuk ends, Vatzipol alai sham yad Hashem Elokim. The hand of God fell upon me. Now that language is used in the first two prophecies as well. It indicates that a vision is beginning, as we'll see. But if I ask you hear the notion that the hand of God falls upon someone, what sort of experience do you think in terms of, you know, how the prophet experiences it? What do you think that it feels like? Does it feel good, easy, calm, if the hand of God falls upon you?
I would be frightened.
Yeah. Seems pretty overbearing. Say again, Robbie?
Pretty intimidating.
Right. It seems pretty overbearing. It's not God spoke to me. The hand of God fell upon me. And it's not for no reason. These are not exactly the most pleasant prophecies. But he's very descriptive. You can tell Yechezkel in a certain sense is just so overwhelmed by the experience of seeing God in a sense, but also totally distraught at what God's telling him, right? It's this double experience. Okay, so let's get into this vision. It's quite a vision. And I saw. He needs a mutz kamare ish mimare matzna v'lamata ish. I saw there was a figure like the appearance of fire from his loins and below was fire, and from his loins and above was the resplendent appearance. It says here, amber. Chashmal, chashmala, difficult word. To translate, we say electricity. They didn't have electricity, so it's probably not what it's describing. Chazal say chashmal. We can't even talk about it. That's how they explain it. Rashi, by the way, what is this referring to? What's this demut kamar ish? Does you recognize it at all? Anyone recognize that term? The fire and.
Was that from the first prophecy, yes, the chariot?
Yes, maybe. Yes, exactly. In fact, interestingly, it's the very end of the first chapter. If you remember the first chapter, it describes the angels at first and the chariot. There are chayot and ofanim. And ultimately, at the very end, there's this image of the zemut kamar eish mimarei matzav lamata. And then it's that is the mutmare kivot Hashem. So this is the very end of that image. It doesn't go. This is the same image Yechezkel always sees. This is the image of the divine chariot. Yechezkel sees his prophecies through. And he always tells us this. And he actually refers back to his earlier prophecies. We'll see. It is interesting that here we cut right to the end of that vision. He doesn't describe the chariots. Abarbanel says, very briefly, I don't want to spend too much time on this. Rashi tells us again here, it is prohibited to contemplate upon this verse. So I am going to take Rashi at his word and not spend too much time contemplating this verse. But I will share with you the comment of Barbanel, who says that the reason we jump to the end of the vision of the divine chariot here, the image, is because this comes directly from God. It is not indirect through the medium of his angels. This punishment we're about to see comes directly from him. Okay. So he sees this image. Vayishlach tavnit yad. He sent the image of a hand. Vayikacheni b'tzitzit roshi. He took me by the locks of hair on my head. Tzitzit roshi. Well, why describe it in that way? Why is he taken by the locks of his head? So it doesn't sound like a very pleasant thing, someone dragging him. But I saw one before us, Rav Elazar. I don't have the exact name right over here. Just give me a second. I want to pronounce his name right. You don't find him elsewhere too often, but Rav Elazar mi Balgansi suggests that it refers back to what Hashem told Yechezkel to do. Again, if you think Yechezkel actually did it, he shaved his head. He shaved all the hair off his head. So not all of it had grown back yet. All that was left were a few locks of hair on his head. Hashem grabbed him by those. Interesting. But Tisoti Ruach Ben Aretz Ben Hashemayim, he carried me. Picture the image here. Like Yechezkel is describing this image that he sees, this vision. He carried me in a wind between the land and the sky. It's like flying in the air. Batave oti Yerushalayim. He brought me to Jerusalem. B'marot Elokim, in the visions of God. El petach shar haplimit haponetzafona. To not just Jerusalem, but to the entrance of the inner gates, which faces the north. Asher Sham Moshav Semel Hakinah Hamakmeh. There in that gate, this is a gate that's on the Temple Mount, which faces the north. At that gate, there is a very cryptic description of something that was there. Sat the sight of an infuriating image that provokes fury. Semel ha-kin'ah, ha-makneh. Kin'ah means jealousy. Makneh means to make jealous. That provokes that jealousy. What does that refer to? Give one guess. What's semel ha-kin'ah, ha-makneh? You have to give a guess. What sort of image would this be? At the gate to the Temple Mount.
Some kind of idol?
Yeah, that would be the basic, that would be your first guess. There's an idol there. On a simple level, that's what Rossi suggests, there was an idol. He sees an idol at the gate to the temple, northern gate, the gate facing north to the Temple Mount. So that is quite disturbing, that they had put an idol on the Temple Mount. And that's what Hashem is showing him. But that's the point of this image, this chapter, is to show Yechezkel what horrific, sinful activity the Jews of Yerushalayim are engaged in. And it gets worse and worse. Malbim can't believe there was actually an image, an idol on the Temple Mount. He says that we don't find, since the time of King Menashe, who was a generation earlier, we don't find that there was an actual idol on Temple Mount. So Malbim suggests something very interesting. He suggests that it's the ramifications of the philosophy of that idol, meaning they believed in almost two deities. There was the good deity and the source of all evil, and then a dualism, there's both. And so this was sort of in order to ensure that their temple service would be accepted. They put this idol at this gate, sort of to get away all of the evil forces and rid them from the temple, through putting the idol outside the temple at this gate, as if to say, we want the evil away from our temple. So this was a form of avodah zarah to this evil deity that they had placed there, even if the idol wasn't there, but the after effects of it, that they still had these beliefs and served this evil force in order to facilitate their service in the temple. That's what they thought they were doing. So very interesting here. Either way, a very disturbing image on the Temple Mount. And in verse 4, we continue.
Doesn't that run the risk of you kind of worshiping or paying homage to the protector?
Yeah.
I mean, that's where the idolatry, yeah.
Well, that's the point.
Yeah.
That's why Hashem's not so happy about it, right?
Yeah.
So this is interesting. Look at this. Nisham kvod Hashem, Nisham there at that gate is kvod Elokei Yisrael, was the honor of the God of Israel. First of all, like, wow. Okay. Like in this vision, I saw a God. Okay, that's quite a dream. Kamare asher ra'iti ba'veka. Like the vision I saw in the valley. Which valley is he referring to? It's referring to his second nevuah. The second nevuah takes place in a valley. If you look in Parag Gimel, Pasuk Chav Gimel, there it says he saw the Mareh Elohim Hashem, akin to the vision he saw on Nahar Kivar in his first vision. So he keeps tracing it back to the previous vision, right? This is like sort of giving you a hint into his prophetic journey. So he sees the image of God there, right? So again, just to take us back to the beginning, Yechezkel sitting in his house, all of a sudden he has this vision. He travels in the air, flying in the sky, all the way back to Yerushalayim, to this northern gate, and he sees this Semel HaKinah HaMakneh, this either image, idol, that causes God to be jealous. That's how what it's called, the Semel HaKinah. But Yomer Eli, Ben Adam Sai Necha Daret Zafona, he says, Ben Adam, son of man, that's how always he says, Mr. Yechezkel, lift up your eyes to the north. V'asayinai Daret Zafona. And I lifted my eyes up to the north. The name Mitzafona Shar HaMizbeach, the north of the gate that led to the Mizbeach, directly in front of the Mizbeach. This is the Mizbeach in the temple. Mizbeach HaNechoshet, where they would offer karbonot. Immediately, to the north of that was the Semel HaKinah HaZeh Baviyah, was this Semel HaKinah, this image of jealousy at the entrance. But Yomer Eli, he said to me, Ben Adam, Haro'eh Atah Mahem Osim, do you see what they're doing? To evoke the Lord Asher Beit Yisrael Osim Po. The great abominations the house of Israel does here. To distance from my sanctuary. And you're going to see even greater abominations. Interesting phrase here. To distance from my sanctuary. Who is being distanced from the sanctuary? Who is it says the rocha me'al mikdashi, to distance, to drive from my sanctuary. Who is being driven away?
Hashem.
A simple level is simply saying by putting an idol in the mikdash that is causing God to leave the sanctuary. But Malbim, relating to what we just discussed, says it's actually two things happening. Their intention was the rocha me'al mikdashi. They intended to distance the evil forces from the sanctuary by putting the Semel HaKinah, this symbol of jealousy, at the entrance to the temple and to send them away. But in reality, by doing so, they're distancing me from my sanctuary. They're causing the divine presence to leave the sanctuary. That's level one, yes.
Is that the same word, the jealousy? Is that the same word as we have in the Ten Commandments, isn't there? Because I'm a jealous God. Tachamud. I beg your pardon?
In Ten Commandments, it's lo tachamud. It's a slightly different word. Okay. That actually entails some act of taking, even stealing. Lo tachamud. But kinah is often used. Hashem is a jealous God. Kel kinah.
Right, yeah.
Right?
And this is the word that they use, the same one that they're using here is the one they use to describe God?
Yeah, Semel HaKinah, 100%. Okay. But the Malbim sees this not just as an idol that makes God jealous, that's Tamachneh, but it's the Semel HaKinah. It is the idol of jealousy, the idol of the divine power's zeal against the world, right? Like it's this evil force. This is the force representing when God gets angry at us. Let's take a statue, put it to the entrance to the temple, and that will satisfy that force so we can serve the good force. That was sort of their philosophy. That
this is the second temple, though, no?
First temple.
Oh, it's the first, because the second one was Sinach Hinnom. Yeah.
Correct. This is the idolatry we discussed in reference to the first temple. You can't conflate Malachi and Yechezkel. Yechezkel was way before, hundreds of years earlier, right? That was last class. We went out of order, though. He brought me to the entrance to the courtyard. And I saw the Nechor Echad Bakir. There was a hole in the wall. But Yomrilai said to me, Ben Adam, son of man, Chatar Na Bakir. Drill in to the wall. Ba'achtor Bakir. And I drilled into the wall. Bine Petach Echad. And there was one opening. But I want to think about this opening for a minute, but I want to go a little bit further so that you can see the next image, okay? By Yomar Eli, he said to me, go see the horrific abominations that they are doing here. But Avo Ve'eran, I went and I saw Vine Kolt Habnit Remesi Ve'hema Sheket. Every image of creeping things and animals and crawling things. V'chol gulei b'Yisrael, all of the disgusting things of Israel, michuke alakir, were depicted on the wall, saviv, surrounding it. V'shevim ish mizikneh b'Yisrael, 70 people from the elders of the house of Israel. V'ya'azanyahu ben Shafan omi b'tocham omdim lefneyeh. And Ya'azanyahu, son of Shafan, stood among them, and they were standing in front of them, in front of these images. V'ishmatak tor b'yado, each had his fire pan in their hand. V'atar anan haketoret ole, and the cloud of the incense ascended. Vayomer Eli, and he said to me, Haraita ben Adam asher zignei be Yisrael osim b'choshech. Do you see, son of man, what the elders of Israel do in the darkness? Ish b'chadrei maskito, each person in his concealed chamber. Ki omrim, they say, Ein Hashem ro'eh otanu, God does not see us. Azav Hashem et ha'aretz, God has abandoned the land. Let's take a pause here and think about this. First, I want to start from verse number 8, Pasuk Chet. What do you think, what is Yechezkel doing? He was at Har Abayah. Remember, he went from Bavel. The first thing he saw was he went from Bavel, went to the gate, and he saw the Semelakina. Then Hashem tells him to drill a hole in the wall. And he does so when he sees the second image. What's the idea of drilling a hole in the wall? What do you think? I want you to think about it, like envision it in your mind. Like what's happening there? Drilling, he drills a hole in the wall, and he looks through. And then there's a door, an opening. And he sees the door and he sees this image of the 70 elders, worshiping Avodah Zarah. So what's the point of drilling the hole?
Well, if you're drilling a hole, it seems to me that you're seeing something that you would not ordinarily be seeing.
Right.
It's something that maybe was hidden, and now you're drilling a hole into it.
100%. Let me ask you this question. Where is he? He's looking through the hole. Where, in terms of the location, where do you think he's seeing into?
The temple, no?
Well, that's interesting. So the temple, he was already at the temple. So why is he like drilling? So I guess you could suggest that there's like some sort of hidden
inner sanctum
near the temple.
Isn't there an inner court?
That's possible. But Abar Benel suggests it's not what's happening here. Abar Benel suggests it's almost like a movie, right? So Yechezkel's not physically traveling to these places, right? So this is all a vision. So he sees himself in the temple mount. Then he drills a hole in the wall as if he's like seeing into these people's private houses, right? Like it's this physical demonstration of him traveling somewhere else. Like he drills a hole in the wall and all of a sudden he sees somewhere else. And it's all these people in their private homes. And it's to represent all the things the Jews were doing in private, in their concealed chambers, wow. Right?
And then that must mean then, excuse me, Rabbi, it must mean if they're doing in their private chambers, they're doing things they're not supposed to be doing.
Well, obviously, that's obviously, you know, the Navi is very clear that this was not an okay thing to do. That's for sure. But I want to think about the following. This is a progression of three abominable practices. Excuse me. Yechezkel witnesses one after the other in succession. And he says, I'm going to show you even worse. I'm going to show you even worse. If that was bad. Let me show you even worse what they're doing. How is this worse than the first image? How is this worse? I think I can think of a number of ways. If you see what's happening here.
Well, I wouldn't be terribly fond of all these creepy things and beasts.
That's number one. Number one, at least, I'm not going to condone any of this, but at least in the first one, it's like Samaha Kina. It's one Hesel. Now it's everything. It's just like tons and tons of images and beasts and creepy things. It seems like it really transcended and became just, you know, incredibly common. This is just the way they worship. It's creepy. So that's certainly one aspect of it. Then what they were worshiping, how, you know, abundant their idol worship was. Anything else? What about in terms of who's doing the worshiping?
Who are the 70 elders?
Well, I don't know, but there's 70 elders.
Is that
elders? Elders are like, elders are usually leaders, right? Religious leaders. And they're the ones doing it. So that can't be good. That can't be good.
It looks to me like witchcraft.
Very much so. And the fact that they're doing it in their house probably tells us, you know, they still function as religious leaders. Like they were still, you know, in shul at the head of the shul on the dais or whatever it was. But this is what they do at home.
Okay, Rabbi.
You, for 70.
Do you have a secret life at home too?
Oh boy. What about the number 70?
Well, isn't that the number of people in the court?
Yeah, in Sanhedrin.
Yeah,
the Sanhedrin. So that doesn't sound so good. There is, by the way, there is always Shavim Zakenim, even the Torah itself. You hear about Shavim Zakenim. But this is number 70. So who is this Yazanyahu ben Shafan person? We don't hear, as best as I know, I did a little searching around. We don't know too much from him about him elsewhere in Tanakh. But it seems like he's important. Some Yazanyahu ben Shafan must have been important. He was their leader. That's why they mention him here. But Malbim suggests, puts two and two together here. Wait, let's see for a second. If there's 70 people, that's the number of people on the court, and then there's this one person, he must have been the Rosh HaSanhedrin. Mm. So Malbim suggests this is the Sanhedrin and the head of the Sanhedrin doing this idolatry. Right? So that's another element in terms of not just the abundance of idolatry, but the people who were engaging in it. And then finally, here's the last part, right? Which I think is the most important. Because it's not just that they worship idolatry, but where do they do it? Where do they worship? Think of it in contrast to the one in the temple. At the temple, there was a Samal HaKina. But where was that Samal HaKina? In public or in private? In the first image.
That was public. It was outside the temple.
Very public. Outside the temple, near the gate. Where's this?
Inside the recesses of whatever, their house.
He was Choter Bakir. He dug a hole into the wall, found a door. It's
the kind of rocket to the court.
It's their concealed chambers.
And not only their concealed chambers, but next you're looking here at the at a censer with incense and smoke, and that further conceals everything.
Right. Okay. Smoke conceals. That's true. So, is that worse or better that it's in private? What do you think?
It's worse. It tends to be more insidious, I think, when it's private.
Right. So on the one hand, public is like, we don't care. But at least it's sort of an openness. This, then the Navi tells you. It tells you the rationale. You don't have to guess. Omrim ein Hashem ro'eh otanu azav Hashem matzaretz. God doesn't see us. He's abandoned the world. Not that they don't believe in God, but they think he doesn't care. He's not paying attention. Maybe he doesn't even know. He doesn't even know. He doesn't see us. He's not aware we can do what we want. It's one thing to believe in two deities. Another thing to say that God doesn't see. And that is the implication of serving God or idolatry in private and serving as religious leaders in public. It's like God doesn't see. So I just say, okay, we'll do this in our, if you serve in idolatry in public, it's not that you're saying God doesn't see, you're just saying, I don't care. Like I'm doing what I want. You're doing it in private. It's like you do care. Or else you would do it in public. But it's as if they're concealing themselves from God. God doesn't know. Well, you know, as long as the people don't see, God doesn't know, we're okay.
But I think they're fooling themselves there too, because God sees everything everywhere.
So that's obviously the point. That's obviously the point. But that's the egregiousness of the sin is increased by the fact that they're doing it in private, in the secrecy of their private chambers, and saying, God doesn't see us. Azav Hashem Mataras. He's left the land. He's abandoned. So that is level two. Okay. Then we go to level three. And we're going to read a few more psukim here to the end of the parak. Okay. Vayomer Elai said to me, O Tashuv Tir'at To'aivot Gidolot Asher Hema Osim. You'll see even worse abominations that they're doing. So bayavuti al petach shar beit Hashem, they brought me to the entrance to the gate of God, the house of God, asher el hatzafona, which was again to the north. Hine sham hanashim yoshvot mivachot et hatamut. Very cryptic statement. There the women were sitting, crying for, or bewailing the Tammuz. What in the world does that mean? Not 100% clear. So you heard the word Tammuz. What do you think of that? Anybody? Tammuz? Go for it, Elliot.
Well, the month.
There's a month of Tammuz.
When the temple was breached.
Well, yes, exactly. Shabbat Asar B'Tammuz. The 3 weeks begin, the 3 weeks in which we mourn the destruction of the two Batei Mikdashot begin in Tammuz. So that's one thing you think about. Now, Tammuz, by the way, the names that we use to identify the Jewish months are not Jewish in origin. In the Torah itself, it doesn't refer to them as Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev, Tevet. It refers to them as Choresh HaRishon, Choresh HaSheni, Choresh HaShlishi, and Choresh HaRishon is Nisan. What we call Nisan, but it's not called Nisan. You don't find the months referred to with those names until the later prophets like Daniel and Ezra and Nehemiah and Megillat Esther, right? Which take place much later in history. But otherwise, you don't find the names Tishrei, Cheshvan, Kislev, and Tevet. You find other names sometimes. In fact, Iyar is referred to as Chodesh Ziv in Navi, which is the month of splendor for whatever reason. Tishrei is sometimes referred to as Yerach Ha'itanim, the month of the giants. But you don't find these names. It's because they're Babylonian in origin. They got them from Galut Bavel. Rabban suggests the reason we use those names is to commemorate the return from Bavel.
Ah.
Just like we used to use Chodesh HaRishon, Nisan was the first month to refer back to the Exodus, the redemption from Egypt. We refer to the hour, month of the year now, with Babylonian names to remember Galut Bavel and our redemption from it and our return to Eretz Yisrael, which takes place later from this prophecy. But what is this notion of women crying over the Tammuz? So here, you have a few different interpretations. Rashi suggests as follows. I'll even, you should be able to see it here if I click on it. Yeah. You see that there in the second column? Sometimes helpful. So Rashi says, it was an image they would heat up from the inside. Its eyes were made of lead. That they would melt from the heat of the fire. And it looked like they were crying. Right? The steam that would emanate from the lead as they burned it appeared like tears. They would say it's asking for an offering. Okay, so that's an interesting form of idolatry. They would burn it, and then there would be the appearance of tears. And it's like, oh, it's crying for an offering. Okay. That's one idea. Rambam, it has an interesting opinion in Moran Eruchim, where the Rambam says, this was, again, and he did his research in his time, where what happened was there was a prophet to idolatry. His name was Tammuz. This prophet's name was Tammuz. And he invited one king to serve these stars or constellations. The king wasn't so happy about it. He killed this prophet named Tammuz. Mm-hmm. And when he died, they gathered all the different slamim, all the different images and idols from all over the world, and they put them in this courtyard. And they cried over the killing, the execution of this idolatrous prophet Tammuz. And that became on what we call Tammuz, the first of Tammuz. It became a tradition to cry over the slaughtering of this prophet and to serve Avodah Zarah. So that's another interesting, apparently Rambam saw this in the paganistic books that existed in his time, and this was the notion of Tammuz. Another interpretation of Barbanel suggests is that there is in the Torah one of the forms of Avodah Zarah mentioned is Molech. Molech involved the burning of children. And in fact, Tammuz, Rashi says, is a language referring to a conflagration. That's what it means, a burning. That's what Tammuz means, heating something up, burning it. And so the way this interpretation goes, they were crying over the children that had been burned alive as a form of this idolatrous practice, serving Molech. So they were literally crying over Tammuz. But Barbanel also says, maybe there is another element here, which it really means Tammuz, in which we know that the evil began B'chodesh Tammuz. The evil began in that month. So that the women were crying over the evil that had befallen them and their people. And they attribute it to the mazal of that chodesh, to the consolation of that month. The force of the month of Tammuz has caused us to suffer from all this evil. But it actually relates to the events Ellie referred to before, the events that took place in Tammuz. Very interesting. That we still call it the month. Ooh, sorry, my fault. I didn't mean to do that. Very interesting that we still refer to the month of Tammuz with this name, considering what it came to represent, right? Be that as it is, we're going to keep Rashi aside because it gets worse. Okay. Vayomer Eli, this is the fourth thing. So that was Nashim Mevakotet HaTammuz. Hara'ita ben Adam Ota Shotra Tavok Dolom Eli. You're going to see even worse than what I've shown you. And here's how it gets the worst. He brought me to the courtyard, the inner courtyard. We're going further into. So it's like we took a break for a second there. We went now, Yechezkel's back in Har HaBayit. And now he's at Chatzar Beit Hashem HaPnimit. He sees the courtyard of the house, the inner courtyard of the house of God. Hinei petach heichal Hashem. Beina ulam uveina mizbeach. It's the how, it's the opening, the entrance to the courtyard of God, between the chamber, the room, the house where the service actually took place, the actual temple, uveina mizbeach, and between the altar. Right. So this is right in front of. If you can picture the temple for a second, the temple, there was this big courtyard outside where there was an altar. That was one altar where they would slaughter the sacrifices. And then there was another gate which led to the chamber, the actual building, the ulam, where there was the Mizbeach HaZahav, the golden altar, and the menorah, and the shulchan, etc. And he's standing right near the entrance in between the Mizbeach and the entrance to the chamber. Okay. There are 25 people there. About 25. Their backs were to the Heichal Hashem, to the courtyard of God. Ufnehem keima. And their faces were directed toward the east. Vehema mishtachavim kedma lashamash. And they were bowing down toward the sun. Okay, so that's the image. Yechezkel sees these people standing right at the entrance to the Beit HaMikdash, the temple itself, the building of the temple. But instead of facing toward the temple, which is to the west, the Arona Kodesh, the Kodesh HaKodeshim, faced, faced the, was at the western end of the building, of the Harabayit. They're not facing toward the Kodesh HaKodeshim. Like when we face east, we're facing toward Eretz Yisrael. In Eretz Yisrael, they're supposed to face toward that place, the Kodesh HaKodeshim. They're facing in the opposite direction, bowing toward the sun. What do you think about that image?
It's idolatry. They're
in the idolatry. They're bowing toward the sun. But what else? Think of that image.
They've turned backs. Their backs. They've turned their backs turned away their backs from them.
Forward God, and instead bowed toward the sun. So that's why you can imagine it's an even worse toeva. It's not just that they worshiped idolatry, and they did it in private. They said Hazal Hashem to Aret, but they brazenly turned their at the place which was dedicated toward the most intimate service of God, being in God's proximity in the first Mikdash, where there was an Aron and Kruvim and the angels and the divine presence, where we know there was a divine presence because that's the whole premise of this book, is the divine presence in the temple, which is leaving. Instead of facing toward that, they turned their backs toward that and faced the sun. In fact, Malbim suggests that the reason that the Aron HaKodesh was in the west was to wean the Jews off of the paganistic practices of the Egyptians and the surrounding nations, who bowed down toward the sun, which rose in the east. Instead, they were bowing toward that and turned their backs toward the west. So that is an incredible chutzpah. That is a toevah gedolah. But it gets worse, according to Chazal. And this is quite gruesome, but it's important to study. Is this a bit redundant? Let's think about this. You know, I have a horrible sense of direction, personally. But if you have a better sense of direction than I do, you know that if their backs are toward one direction, it means their front is toward the opposite direction. So if the Aron HaKodesh was in the west, and the Heichal Hashem is toward the west, so then obviously their faces are toward the east. So what's going on here? So Rashi tells us something. It's on the right side of your screen if you see it, and it ain't pretty. So here we go. Okay, actually, it's maybe worth reading this first Rashi too. It says he brought them to the inner house of God. He says, "Hiya Azara, this is the Azara. This is the courtyard where the Sarvik sacrifices. Kiharabaya Nikraha Chatzera Chitzona. The temple mount is called the outer courtyard. There was the temple mount generally. V'arasha Batochaya Omeid. Asho Nichnas B'Sharet Tzfoni." Or he was outside the actual courtyard of the temple until now. He went into the space within the northern gate. And he showed him in the what's called here the Beit HaChalifot, the Chamber of Knives, this image of Tammuz. Then he brought him to the east. He brought him to the northern gate, to the eastern gate, in front of the courtyard of the Mizbeah. Ufneim Kainma, their faces were toward the east. Okay, here we go. If their faces were toward the east, I know their backs were toward the corner. That's how it works. If you're facing the east, your backs are toward the west. Elash Magid Shehaya Achoreim Migule. Their backsides were revealed.
Ooh.
How you po arin atzmam umatrizin klape mata. Allow you to read the English there. They relieve themselves toward the temple.
Oh, now, blasphemous.
Absolutely. No need to comment too much on that. Mm. No. Does Rashi mean that the Chazal Rashi is quoting from the Gemara here? The Chazal mean that literally or even just figuratively? Turning your back toward the Heichal and bowing to an idol, is that disgusting? Rashi means it literally. I'll tell you how he knows. But that's the gruesomeness that God is showing Yechezkel. You get it? And this is how gruesome, as it were, God must feel. And this is why everything that Hashem says is going to happen is going to happen. Look what they're doing in the temple. Look what they're doing. Is it a wonder God is going to destroy it? But Yomer Eli said to me, Haraita ben Adam, do you see this? Hanikel Vejudah me'asod ha'tovot asher asu bo? Is it not enough that they're doing these disgusting things they're doing here? Hanikel can mean, is that not enough to punish them? Is it become easy for them to do it? Kimalu et ha'aretz Hamas. They filled the world with wickedness, by lawlessness, by ashubu lahachiseni, and they have provoked me further and further. And now we have a very, again, cryptic phrase. Hinein shochim at hazmora el apan. They throw this mora toward their faces. And now we're going to take a look at Rashi again. Did I skip something? 1 second. Okay, actually, 1 second. I want to take a step back before we get to that. The end of, okay, I think it's important. The end of verse 16, Pasuk Tetzayin says, Mishtacha V10. Mishtacha V10 is a bit of an interesting word. There's an extra tough there. Right? It should say Mishtacha V'im. What's Mishtacha V10? Rashi tells us it's actually a word made up of two different words. Take a look here. Mishtacha V10. B'shtei tevot to mishamish. I think it's a very powerful image. This word is two words at once. Lashon hashchata. What's hashchata? Destruction, corruption, decay. And lashon hishtachavaya. It's also a language of bowing down and prostration. Kenu b'Yerushalmi, so it says in Yerushalmi, Mashchitim ha-chechal, they're destroying the courtyard, Mishachavim l'chama. They're prostrating themselves toward the sun. I think there's a very powerful image here. The notion of hishtachavaya, prostration, is itself the greatest form of honor, of divine service, the nullification of the self. It's a beautiful thing. They're taking the power of Hishtachavaya and directing it toward the sun. That is hashchata. That's destructive. It's corrupted. That destroys the temple. When you take something as powerful as a religious expression, as Hishtachavaya, and direct it toward the Chama, and turn your back toward the Mikdash, that same power of Hishtachavaya becomes Hashchata. That's the language of Hishtachavita. Okay, let's get back to Pasuk Yizayin here, and it gets even worse. What Shochim HaTazmora Elapan? Take a look here again, just at this Rashi. So, what is that? What's Zmora? Rashi translates Mora, as other Mefarshim do, as a foul odor. They're sending the foul odor to their faces. So, one way Rashi interprets this is based on his previous interpretation. Shochim el chotmam. What does it mean, their faces? Whose faces? So, the way Rashi interprets it is the B'nai Israel's faces, these people's faces. How are they sending the bad odor to their faces? Well, it's based on what we just said. They're sending the foul odor from this, you know, disgusting scent they bring up with the odor that comes out from behind them that we just referred to. That's the disgusting foul odor we're referring to. Others suggest, in fact, that it's a euphemism. It's referring to their burning of sacrifices to foreign gods. And apam is a euphemism in the sense that it shouldn't really say apam. It should say api. They're sending the foul odor toward my face. But rather than say such a brazen thing so explicitly, to lessen the how vile the image is, the Torah, the Navi uses the word apam. So that is the degree of vile, foul behavior. And it's so powerful. This image, Yechezkel is transported as these elders of Judah ask what's going to happen to the Jewish people in Jerusalem and the temple. Yechezkel sees a very vivid image of what they are engaged in, the abomination, the utter disgrace of God that they are performing. And he says, I too will act with anger. I will not have pity or compassion. They will cry then in my ear with a great voice. I'm not going to listen. So this is an incredibly powerful, painful image that Yechezkel shares in chapter 8. Next week, we see another image, and that vision is Hashem shows Yechezkel what is to come, the punishment to come next. And that will also be a very powerful demonstration of what Hashem has in store for Yerushalayim. We'll pick up with that next week, please, God. Thank you very much, everybody. Wishing
you
luck.
Yes, thank you, Yeshua. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Rabbi.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Absolutely my pleasure. Absolutely.